Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, the host of Sound Effect, and along the Seattle waterfront, there is a freezer full of delicious seafood.
And so we have surf clam, we have mackerel, capelin, pollock filet, yummy Dungeness crab.
Beautiful. Oh, those are gorgeous.
Yeah.
We're not in the basement of a restaurant. Most of this food is for marine mammals who spend most of their time in the water, playing, floating, diving. We're talking about the sea otters at the Seattle Aquarium. Caroline Hempstead is one of the aquarium's animal care specialists, and she knows everything about these insanely adorable creatures.
For one sea otter in a year, it's about $15,000 to feed one sea otter. And we have five sea otters, so their budget's about $75,000 in just a year.
Each individual has different characteristics, kind of like humans. We all do a little bit differently. With Lutos, especially when she eats, she looks like she's almost playing like a double banjo or something. She'll do this with her front paws. Aniak will do a lot of times like a little spy hop. She'll like kind of put her paws together like a little prayer. One otter loves her Dungeness crab, but the others, they could take it or leave it. See, that's my favorite.
The otters eat most of their food in the water.
They do float on their backs, and they eat on their backs just like they are, and they're using their chest and their tummy as a table. So when they're foraging for food, they'll get as much as they can during their dive. And then they'll all just like, okay, I got my food. And then they know it's the end of mealtime.
And then there'll be six other mealtimes after this.
Yeah. And we'll feed all up until about 8 or 9 o'clock tonight.
So their day is mostly just playing in the water and eating delicious seafood.
I know. If there's no better life, I don't think.
How many hours of the day does a sea otter spend in the water?
Pretty much, I would say 90% of the time.
Today on Sound Effect, while we won't necessarily be frolicking like sea otters, we will be spending some time around the water. The theme, underwater. We'll hear about one of the most amazing ship rescues in maritime history. We'll check in with a water protector at Standing Rock. And we'll look back at a one-of-a-kind sporting event that happened in Puget Sound waters decades ago, involving the octopus. These stories and more just ahead. The main character of our first story is currently under nearly 9,000 feet of water. It's the MS Prinsendam. It was a Holland-America cruise ship that left the Northwest in the fall of 1980. There were 324 passengers aboard and 200 crew members, and they were on the adventure of a lifetime, a trip across the Pacific Ocean that would eventually take them to Japan. But the Prinsendam never made it. It sank in the Gulf of Alaska. But here's the thing. Every single person aboard survived in what is considered the largest high seas rescue in maritime history. Maybe one of the luckiest, too. 88.5's Ed Ronco has the story.
There are movies about disasters at sea. Movies designed to heighten the drama and tell an unforgettable story.
We've got to stay here till help arrives.
Help from where? From the captain? He's dead.
I would argue that movies like that have nothing on the real-life sinking of the MS Prinsendam. Nothing.
By the time of the Prinsendam, I had almost died a violent death at least a dozen times because of the way I was doing with my life.
John Graham was a foreign service officer for the U.S. government. It's the kind of job where you travel the globe, but you're not always welcomed, and sometimes you have to leave countries in a hurry. I met up with him at a reunion of survivors and rescuers held in Seattle on the 35th anniversary of the disaster. In the fall of 1980, John had just been hired as part of the ship's entertainment staff. He was going to use his background in foreign service to give a couple of lectures on the trip to Japan.
And it turned out after the first night, part of my job also was to waltz blue-haired widows around the dance floor, but I didn't know that then.
More than 300 passengers were aboard, some of them perhaps blue-haired widows. John brought his then 13-year-old daughter Mallory along for the trip, and after 3 days of traveling up Alaska's Inside Passage, Mallory had just gone to sleep in her cabin when an announcement came over the ship's loudspeakers. Smoke in the engine room. Nothing too serious, though, they said. They're working to clear it out. So Mallory went back to bed.
And then a little bit later on, my dad woke me up, and there was another announcement that, oh, well, we haven't been able to clear out the smoke, so we're doing live entertainment and free food up on the, you know, the Lido deck.
Up on deck, entertainers were performing. Selections from a Rodgers and Hammerstein review.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
On some level, it might have been good in terms of there was no panic among the passengers. Everyone was fairly calm. But we really had no idea that anything was wrong.
Beneath them, something was very wrong. A fire in the engine room, and it was growing.
So suddenly, it was no longer, there's no problem, there's just a little smoke. It was, we were outside, and I could see the flames at the other side of the ship.
The order came to get into the lifeboats. Mallory, her father John, and more than 500 others, passengers and crew, began piling in.
The fact that there were almost 90 people in a lifeboat designed for 45, or I think 47 it said, meant that we were warmer, because no one had warm clothes.
Or medications, or provisions. They just got into the boats. While they were doing that, the call for help went out, and the response was massive. Two nearby ships, three Coast Guard cutters, some of their crews awakened or even pulled out of bars in Juneau in the middle of the night, and aircraft from the Coast Guard, the U.S. Air Force, and the Royal Canadian Air Force. As daylight arrived, John and Mallory were awaiting rescue in lifeboat number 2.
I remember once, shortly before noon, a crewman, who should have known better, got up in the middle of that lifeboat and he shouted at the top of his lungs in broken English that we were all going to die. He just kind of completely lost it. And a woman from New Jersey, from one of New Jersey's oldest, finest families, I know because I'd waltzed her around the dance floor the night before, she got up and she belted this guy in the face. She said, "How dare you? Sit down and shut up." And he did, and that averted a moment of panic.
Soon the rescuers arrived. So did a storm, the remnants of Typhoon Vernon. The seas are churning. Lifeboats are riding out each new wave, rising and falling, rising and falling, rising and falling. People are getting sick. Three Coast Guard cutters have arrived, along with an oil tanker and another ship. There are planes flying overhead as spotters. Rescue crews have been dropped into the lifeboats to take charge in clearing them out, and helicopters are plucking people one by one from below and ferrying them to a waiting rescue vessel.
A helicopter came over our lifeboat, and they sent down a metal basket, and they took one person up one at a time. And the movie Star Wars had just come out, right? So it had just been out a couple years earlier. And the man who was hauling up the basket was wearing a white helmet and an orange jumpsuit. And I was sure that I was being rescued by Luke Skywalker.
Below, John watched his 13-year-old daughter lifted away from him in a dangling metal chair. Soon, the storm grew worse. The helicopters could no longer fly, and now John and seven others were left in the boat, waiting in the dark for help.
We were ready to die. We knew the odds were that we were going to die. If I had to die then, these were a good seven people to die with.
As the storm intensified, the remaining passengers on lifeboat number 2 saw the Coast Guard cutter Boutwell crashing toward them through the waves. John Graham caught a line from the cutter and tied it off. The ocean heaved, and the line ripped away a side of the lifeboat. Crewmen from the cutter lowered something called a horse collar. It's a rescue strap on the end of a huge pole. And one by one, the people aboard the lifeboat positioned the collar underneath their arms and around their backs. The time for polite hoisting was over.
These guys on decks would all heave as hard as they could, and we'd go flying off through the air. So like we were like a piece of tuna or a tuna We kept flying through the air, flopping down on the deck.
Finally, John was aboard the Boutwell, bruised, cold, but alive. John was taken to Sitka. Mallory aboard a different vessel went to Valdez and then Anchorage, some 600 miles away from her dad.
And I was totally, alone on my own. I didn't know anyone. And when I think about that at the time and being 13 years old, I was like, wow. But, you know, you've also just been in, 30-foot seas, been throwing up over the side of a lifeboat. So at that point, you're like, well, okay, whatever comes next, I can do this.
They were reunited in Seattle a few days later. Last year, Mallory and John reunited with many of their rescuers at Coast Guard Base Seattle. Mallory says, as a result, she now has a Facebook feed filled with Coast Guard retirees, people with whom she has very little in common, except for the fact that they rescued her. Mallory and John both live in Western Washington today. Mallory in Seattle, John is on Whidbey Island, and they've both been on cruises since their brush with maritime disaster back in 1980. It's not big ships or even ferries that scare her, Mallory told me. It's the little boats, like the lifeboat that saved her. She gets seasick easily. She does not like being on the water very much and forget underwater. She says you could not pay her enough money to go scuba diving. But then she stops and thinks about it. The 13-year-old girl who spent 10 hours stranded at sea in 1980 turns 50 years old next month. She's planning to spend her birthday on a beach in Mexico. And she says maybe, just maybe, she'll strap on some goggles and a tank tried to conquer her fear of being underwater.
That was 88 Vibes, Ed Ronco. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is underwater. For Tracy Rector, a Northwest filmmaker, the water has always been a scary place. She never even learned to swim as a kid.
I was always that kid at summer camp who was the only one who couldn't pass the swimming test. And if you could just imagine me with my pigtails and big pop bottle glasses sitting on the bench, watching everyone swim. I felt a certain fear about the unknown nature of water. And so I had never really felt safe or secure enough to dive in.
But as Tracy grew up and became a filmmaker, that changed. Tracy is an indigenous woman, a member of the Seminole and Choctaw tribes. She decided to use her films to explore the connection between Native peoples in the Northwest and the environment. And here in the Northwest, an essential part of that is water. Tracy's upcoming feature film is Clearwater. It's a documentary, and making it involved researching tribal stories and legends about water, spending hours by the water with Native fishers, divers, and boat builders.
And so I began going on canoe journeys and slowly but surely becoming more and more acclimated to the water. And eventually, after going on canoe journey in 2013, really falling in love with the water.
What made you fall in love?
You know, it was after canoe journey finished, I noticed that I just felt unsettled and that something was missing. And I went down to Lake Washington and I heard the waves come ashore and I realized, oh, it's the water. My body needs to be near water. My emotions react to the sound of the waves. That following summer, I tried to learn how to swim. I still can't swim. but I'm no longer afraid. And you know, this is a big turning point for me in understanding the work of our film Clearwater, is that when we create a safe space of beauty and experiential joy, that once there's this emotional connection, this opening, that there's a way people will be able to face their fears or to perhaps think in different ways. And we hope that means that there will be a renewed sense of being stewards of the land and the water.
As you have put this documentary together, what are some of the Native stories involving water that have surprised you the most?
One of the stories that I find most beautiful is called The Maiden of Deception Pass. And it's a story that we recently made a film about. It's a story about a young maiden who was asked by this undersea creature to marry him. And if she did not, he would take away the sea life and the food from her tribal people, the Samish. And her father said, if you must, you can go, but please come back once a year and visit your family. And so she chose to sacrifice herself for the sake of her community. And once a year she came back, but each year when she returned, she had more barnacles and seaweed, and she herself was beginning to transform into a sea creature. And there was a point when she wanted to return, she simply could not. She was no longer able to breathe the air. And so she remains in the sea today as a source of protection and guidance. And that was one of the most beautiful stories that I've heard in recent years. And understanding how this is just a guiding light for the Samish Nation, but also other tribal peoples living in that region. There's this idea of sacrifice for the greater good that guides many people's hearts and values.
We spoke to filmmaker Tracy Rector just days before she drove the 18 hours with her teenage son to North Dakota. She went to stand in solidarity with thousands of other Indigenous people from across the country to prevent the construction of an oil pipeline through Standing Rock Sioux tribal lands. Many are also concerned that the pipeline's location and the possibility of an oil leak could threaten hundreds of miles of the Missouri River. Earlier this week, the Obama administration announced that the Army Corps of Engineers would look for an alternative route to the pipeline, although that decision could be reversed under President-elect Donald Trump. We asked Tracy why Native people at Standing Rock aren't calling themselves protesters, but instead say they are water protectors.
So water protectors really encapsulates the fact that this is a movement not just about tribal people for tribal people, but it's a movement to protect Mother Earth, as well as to acknowledge the spiritual importance of water. If we don't protect the water now, what's our future going to look like?
How are you a water protector here and when you arrive in North Dakota?
So I see myself as a water protector because I try to remain aware and awake about my impact as a human being, just in my everyday life, but also as a filmmaker, my responsibility to call attentions to issues that impact our water. And living in the Pacific Northwest, where we're surrounded by so many amazing mountains and rivers and waterways, such as the Salish Sea, it's part of who we are and our identity as people from this region.
And the tribes here in Washington State, they have fought for water rights. How do they compare to the water protectors today in North Dakota at Standing Rock?
Yeah, there's so many circles of relationship in all of this that I am beginning to see. So, for example, the Lummi Nation, who fought and are fighting for the health of the water in their region and Cherry Point and against the coal trains, their work as protesters and protectors of the land really in many ways influenced this action happening at Standing Rock. And there's also another piece of history that is critical to this. 40 years ago, when there was the fish wars before the Bolt decision, many people from the Dakotas came out in solidarity to stand with Coast Salish peoples to fight in those fish wars. And so many of those elders who were alive at that time are in North Dakota now, standing in solidarity with those who came to lend a hand. And there's these many relational stories that seem to be coming full circle right now.
And just to to back up a second, for those of you who weren't around then, the Bolt decision was a federal court ruling that upheld treaty fishing rights for tribes, that they're entitled to, I believe, up to 50% of the salmon in the water. With Standing Rock, what exactly is at stake for you in all of this?
Sure. It was interesting. The other day, I was asked, because I'm bringing my son with me to Standing Rock, aren't you concerned because this is being deemed an illegal protest? And I've been thinking about this, that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that it was illegal for Native Americans, African Americans, women to vote. And just because something's illegal doesn't necessarily make it right or wrong. This, for me, is an issue about values and about being a mother and wanting to set an example for my children. So what's at stake for me is future generations and wanting to really acknowledge that what I do today, what anyone does in the present, is going to affect 7 generations forward.
That was Indigenous rights activist and filmmaker Tracy Rector. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're looking underwater. And joining me now in the studio is 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe. Hello, Bellamy.
Hey, Jennifer.
So we've heard some interesting underwater stories so far, but you've come across some odd ones, and they involve octopuses.
Yeah. As it turns out, the Puget Sound area is home to a variety of very strange octopus-related urban legends and stories.
Okay, like what?
Well, one of the best urban legends from the Tacoma area is that there's a 600-pound octopus living under the Narrows Bridge. Over the years, divers have reported seeing this massive and apparently very elusive creature in the ruins of Galloping Gertie.
That's really big, 600 pounds. It's like our very own Loch Ness monster. Is there any evidence that this creature actually exists?
No, not really. No photographs or anything like that. Plus, octopuses only live for about 4 years, and tales of this massive octopus have been around significantly longer than that.
Are there any octopus stories that we know are actually real?
Well, yeah. The World Octopus Wrestling Championships.
What? The Octopus Wrestling Championships?
Yeah, it was a real thing.
All right, you're going to have to explain that.
Well, back in the early 1960s, the waters off Titlow Beach near the Tacoma Narrows was home to this event, the World Octopus Wrestling Championships. It was televised, and 1 year, about 5,000 people showed up on the beach to watch, and over 100 divers were participating.
That's a lot of people. So what exactly is octopus wrestling?
Well, when you hear wrestling, it's probably not quite what you imagine. It's not like the wrestling you see strongmen doing on TV. Divers would go into the water in teams and basically do their best to pull an octopus out of the water. There were 2 categories, one if you use scuba gear and one if you free dove.
And I imagine that they might have an advantage with 8 arms. But how did you win this if you were one of the divers?
Well, if you were free diving, you got 2 points per pound. And if you had scuba gear on, you got 1 point per pound. Whoever wrestled the biggest octopus out of the water was the winner. And some of these octopuses that they pulled out weighed as much as 60 pounds.
How did this come to be? Who thought of this?
It was the brainchild of a diving club called the Puget Sound Mud Sharks. They did things like spearfishing and other competitions. And one of the co-founders of that club is a man named Gary Keffler. He was actually very well known in the diving community. He worked as a stunt double for TV shows when underwater scenes were being filmed around here. And he ran underwater sports in Seattle for quite some time until handing it off to his children. I paid him a visit there, and he very matter-of-factly just said they wanted to do something different.
Something to do, I guess, go out and wrestle an octopus. So we decided we'd hold, and since we had the largest octopus in the world in shallow water, we decided, well, it might be a nice event to try and run and do. We did. Turned out pretty good. It's a challenge. So from that challenge, we turned it into a contest.
Was this dangerous? It doesn't really sound like the safest thing to do.
I asked Keffler about that, and he said there are some risks, but in general, octopus are not that dangerous.
You had to be just a little careful about them grabbing your mask or getting a hold of your hose. And those days, they had two hose regulators, and they could crimple it, tighten it up so the air would be cut off a little bit. The octopus we handled were not the giant ones you see. Most of them were running probably 50, 60 pounds and ran 7, 8, 10, 11, 12 feet across. And once in a great while, you would get a real big one. But they don't have the strength. They can't come up and squeeze you, but they can hang on tight with the suckers on their tentacles. But you could pull them loose and then keep them off of you. They didn't move fast, and that was a thing that people don't understand.
Bellamy, did any of these octopuses get hurt?
Well, Keffler says almost all of them were returned to the water, with the exception of a few that were donated to local aquariums.
So you have these TV cameras. 5,000 people are showing up to watch divers pull these creatures out of the water. Did anything else interesting happen?
Well, Jacques Cousteau showed up.
Like the guy, Jacques Cousteau?
Yep.
Wow.
He ended up taping part of a film there. It's called Octopus, Octopus.
From the Pacific to the Mediterranean, Captain Cousteau and Calypso divers would now observe and photograph one of man's most curious contemporaries, the much maligned octopus, and seek the truth about this enigmatic cave dweller of the sea.
Wow, so why haven't we heard of this before?
Well, the octopus wrestling only lasted a couple of years, and Keffler, again, very matter-of-factly, says they did it, and after a few years, it was just time to move on to something else.
Huh, wow. Would this even happen today?
Well, I do think that the arrival of Jacques Cousteau on the scene kind of coincide with a general turning point in society around conservation of these creatures, interest in studying them and harming them less. Don't forget that the orca hunting that had gone on was also changing at this time. And so, you know, when I asked Gary Keffler how he feels about the octopus now, I asked him, you know, well, what did you respect most about this creature? And it was interesting to hear him say that really, he found them very beautiful.
I think their beauty and their way their fluid movements, the way they swam, beautiful to watch move in the water. They can, it's interesting, they change colors to match their surrounding. There's no reason, unless you're going to get it for food, to harm them or take them, you know, so why bother hurting something that isn't hurting you?
And so you see the attitude that they had previously in terms of hunting and wrestling these out and making a spectacle of it. That kind of thing I don't think could ever happen in this day and age. I mean, recently we had the big uproar with Dylan Mayer. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
This young art student just a few years ago wrestled an octopus out of the water and was caught on film doing so. And the end result was that the State Department of Natural Resources has banned the octopus hunt in like 8 public diving areas. Mm. So people really have shifted their attitudes, but it sure is interesting to pull back the curtain and understand that it's only been a few decades since that attitude changed.
Thank you very much, Bellamy.
Thanks, Jennifer.
That's 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe sharing some odd octopus stories with us here on Sound Effect. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX, and I'm Jennifer Wing. Our theme today is underwater, and I am here at this lovely little pocket beach near Seattle's Sculpture Garden. I brought with me a coffee mug, and I just filled it with some water from Elliott Bay, and the water inside the mug is clear with a few bits of sand in it. It doesn't look like much, but the reality is, inside this mug, scientists can extract hundreds, if not thousands, of DNA strands that can paint an incredibly detailed picture of all of the life that's alive right now in this ginormous body of water before me. And one of the people
pushing the possibilities of this new technology is Professor Ryan Kelly. He's a biologist and an attorney at the University of Washington.
I think when we think about science, we think that scientists sort of have some magical way of doing whatever they're trying to do in the world. And it's not at all true. Scientists are just like everybody else. And if you wanted to know how many frogs were in a pond, scientists to know how many frogs are in a pond are going to do exactly what you would do to find out how many frogs are in the pond or how many fish are in the sea. They're going to go out and try and catch frogs and try and count them. It's not sexy and it's not magic. It's we go count frogs. So what we've been working on is a way of trying to make that easier. Instead of counting one species at a time by hand, we are using the traces of DNA that those animals leave behind, where we could take a glass of water, sequence the DNA out of it, and tell you what's living nearby.
Have you done a control where, say, you have a pond with 15 frogs, and then you scoop up the water, and you sequence the DNA, and you come up with the same number?
We have done that. We did it at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. We went and asked, what's the biggest tank you have? And the biggest tank they had was 4 million liters.
The one with all the sardines.
One with the sardines is called the open sea tank. We took a liter of water out of a 4 million liter tank. We didn't ask what fish were in the tank just yet, and we looked at the DNA that we got out of the water. And so it turned out that we had a pretty good, not a precise estimate of how many of the different fish, but we were able to see most of the fish that were in that tank using just the DNA. And so that gave us some confidence that what we were doing wasn't crazy, that we could work backwards from the DNA to sort of have some idea of what was there. And then what we did next was go out into the ocean right next to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, actually, at Hopkins Marine Station, which is Stanford's marine lab. We said, okay, well, this works in a more or less controlled environment in the aquarium. Can we make it work out in the field? So we drove a little boat and had divers in the water. The divers were counting the fish as they swam from habitat to habitat, from a seagrass bed through a sandy bottom, through a kelp forest and rock reef. And then they were counting fish along the way, and we were grabbing bottles of water. And we sequenced the DNA, and we compared it to their answers of how many fish they saw. And what was remarkable about that was that we saw the same fish that they did, by and large.
From the glass of water.
DNA we saw the same fish that they saw, and we saw a lot more. Right? This is always true. The DNA is going to pick up hundreds or even thousands of species, and when you're counting, you're counting a handful of species at most. And so that's one thing that's really exciting here, is not just that it works, but it works and shows us hundreds or thousands of species all at once. But what was more remarkable was we saw them in the same places. What we're sampling is what we're sampling here and now in the environment. So the question I get a lot is, how do you know you're not seeing dinosaur DNA? Right. And what people mean when they say that is, well, I know that DNA can last for a long time, and we have a mammoth sequence that we pulled out of out of Russia in the permafrost. How do you know you're not seeing
pleosaurs?
Right. You could see pleosaur DNA in Puget Sound. The reason we know that is that we've done the experiments. And if you're in Puget Sound or anywhere else in today's ocean, that DNA degrades pretty fast. And so that's useful for us because it means what we're seeing is here and now.
This is so exciting because you can create a baseline of what exists in the ocean without actually having to physically eyeball every living thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So for things like Deepwater Horizon or Exxon Valdez, when we have these big disasters, the first question everybody wants to know is, well, what's the effect of that? And the answer is, well, we didn't have a lot of baseline information. It wasn't like we were just out there counting things every day until Deepwater Horizon happens, like waiting for a disaster so that we could measure the effect of that disaster, right? So things like this that make it easier and cheaper and more effective to do that sort of baseline monitoring of the marine environment, we could do in a routine way for not much money. And then when something bad happens or when something great happens, then you could ask, well, what is the effect of that?
Right. If we cordon off a section and make it a marine sanctuary, go back and test it after it's been that way for 10 years and say, oh, there's actually an uptick in the biodiversity here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What are some of the strange things, the surprising things you found?
my favorite surprising story is when we did the aquarium study in Monterey Bay. And we looked at our DNA results and we're getting all these fish, like Atlantic menhaden. This is a fish from the Atlantic that's like a food fish that has no business being in an aquarium of the Pacific Ocean in Monterey Bay, right? And they were sort of worried. Actually, the Monterey Bay Aquarium staff were like, well, what is an Atlantic species doing? And how do you get that DNA? It must be a mistake. And then we said, well, can you give us a sample of the food that you feed those fish? And sure enough, the food that they use a couple of different types of food in that particular exhibit, and we were able to sequence the DNA from the food, and that accounted for all the species that that we couldn't figure out where they were coming from. So the real surprise there is that we're sampling DNA from a 4 million liter tank, and we're getting a few mysterious species, and it's coming from the feed that they're feeding the fish. So the technique is so sensitive that not only are we seeing the fish in the tank, we're seeing the food that those fish ate.
How is this being applied right now out in the world?
Well, our most recent study was looking at the effect of upland urbanization on Puget Sound. We were interested in how the whole watershed might affect eelgrass habitats in Puget Sound, and in particular the animals that live on that eelgrass. And much to our surprise, when we looked at the DNA, it was it actually showed us that the more urban areas had more different kinds of species living there, which was a real surprise to us. And when we dug into the data a little bit, it turned out that almost all of that increase is clams. So different kinds of clams living in sort of muddy, sandy habitats in the eelgrass beds seem to do better near more urban environment. Is it that the clams are coming to the humans or the humans are coming to the clams? And we can't answer that question yet.
To be continued.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Ryan Kelly, thank you so much for joining us here on Sound Effect.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is underwater. Colin McDaniel grew up on the water. He was raised on Bainbridge Island, and in the summers, Colin and his best friend Adam loved exploring the island's coast. Adam's father had a fleet of unloved dinghies.
They all had those drain holes under the water line, and no drain hole plugs to be found anywhere. But that didn't stop us from shoving green fir cones into the drain holes and pushing our boats into the gray water and going out for adventures anyway.
Today, Colin McDaniel is an English teacher at Federal Way High School, but he wasn't always fond of school. Colin and Adam weren't popular or good at sports. Those early teen years were an awkward and insecure time for both of them. But all of that changed with one magical boat.
It was late in the summer of 1985, in August, when we discovered the sea wolf. It was a few weeks before our freshman year of high school. And I think, at that time we were anxious about entering high school. We just sat inside Adam's house and played with his Atari or impotently flicked the remote control until his dad got tired of us moping around and said, "Why don't you boys go out and do something with that blackberry bramble that's taking over the garage?" And he gave us a pair of machetes. That blackberry bramble was enormous. It had grown down the hill and completely covered one side of this detached garage. And you couldn't see into the thing. It was impenetrable, it seemed. So we started working away at these vines, and suddenly my blade hit something quite solid. It spoke back in a ting, and we did a bit of carving, and we discovered a warped license plate on a rusty black metal frame. And with a bit more clearing, we discovered that it was a boat trailer with a small boat on it. So we ran back into his house, and we found his dad, and we we interrogated him about this boat. And he said, oh, that thing. He and his buddy had got it at the Rotary auction, taken it out, and on the first sail, they had flipped it over, declared it a witch, and put it on the trailer and shoved it beside the garage and had forgotten about it since. We went out there and we uncovered this boat, and indeed it was a sailboat, black-hulled, fiberglass, about 15 feet long, fairly simple design, and had white side decks and a white foredeck. And inside it was gray, but the paint was all peeling off. We went back in and asked some more questions to his dad, and we shoved a ladder up into the rafters of the garage, and Adam soon found a mast and a boom, the rudder, a board, and even a bag with sails in it, and we were in business. So we cleaned up this boat and started to put it together. The grown-ups even shared our enthusiasm enough to give us rides to the hardware store or the chandlery so we could buy cleats and lines and things that we needed to fix her up. And then there came the day when we finally raised her sail, and we were terribly dismayed when up it went and we saw this big red heart. It was unmanly. So we did what any man would do. We overcompensated. We went back to the hardware store, got some block white decal letters, and we emblazoned the transom with its name, Seawolf. And so on a fair day late in August, with our work done on the boat to the best of our ability, we slid her into the water, and when it was deep enough, we dropped the rudder blade and hoisted the sails, and we were able to claw away from Point White Dock, and in a few tacks, we were free. As we learned to gain confidence in our boat, we gained confidence in ourselves and in our friendship. With this boat, we went to new places, literally, across Port Orchard to Illihee State Park, for instance, taking us to places that we had not gone with our families. And then the weather changed when we got to October. The wind switches around and starts to come out of the south. It can bring with it more white caps on the water, more challenging sailing conditions. And we enjoyed those, but we weren't fully aware of the toll it was taking on the Seawolf. And one afternoon in late October, we sailed her out on our favorite run to Illihee State Park, across Port Orchard, to the public dock where we tied up and made the journey up to the little general store we had found, where we could buy snacks and candy and reprovision ourselves for the voyage back. We set off from the dock with the wind behind us, and the wind had picked up, and we found ourselves racing along at great speed toward Adams Beach. And the boat shuddered with each acceleration as she surfed down those waves, and the vibration could be felt in the tiller and the rudder, which was shaking violently. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't feel anything in the tiller at all. And I looked back, and the rudder was literally falling into the water. And I reached down with my left hand and I grabbed the rudder blade and just held it there with my arm in the water, trying to steer this boat. So we raised the dagger board and held on for the next perilous half hour, surfing down these waves until we came to the beach and we ran her right up on those barnacle armored rocks. And there was a terrible scraping sound as she raced up there, and the rudder blade, of course, popped right out of my hand. We jumped out of the boat and pulled her up to safety, and we leaned her over on one side so we could inspect the bottom, and it looked like a great claw had just torn away at the bottom of the hull, but it was cosmetic. There was nothing structurally wrong. It would just need a bit of putty here and there and some paint, so another project. Well, first trimester came to an end, and finals kept us very busy. And then my parents moved. My mom found a job in Gig Harbor. And so in the middle of my freshman year, I moved away from Bainbridge Island. And Adam and I kept in touch. But Adam was busy with other things, got involved in cross country and meeting girls. And I found other boats in Gig Harbor. And the Sea Wolf was eventually towed back up alongside the garage and left there. And over the years of high school, those blackberry vines grew back and grew right over the boat and alongside the garage. And she disappeared again in that pile of vines. I feel she was given to us. I feel she was really a gift, something that we needed at the time to grow, a vehicle in which we could sail through dark waters and find ourselves, and find ourselves competent and able. One chooses a boat because it has a certain personality, a certain grace, and a certain kind of beauty. It's like finding a mate. And I don't know that anything else that we build and design is as intentional or as beautiful or as complex as a sailboat, nor do we put as much trust and faith into that creation. When we can no longer take care of it, it takes care of us.
Colin McDaniel is an English teacher at Federal Way High School. That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Allie Ferguson and Kevin Kniestead. Special thanks goes out to 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe, Ed Ronco, and Dick Stein. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app, and you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you'd like to share a story, you can send us an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week when our theme is odd couples.
I think that you had a really typical first cuddling experience. I think in the beginning you were like, okay, I'm doing this. And your body was still like, oh yeah, we're doing this. And as the time went on, you relaxed into it and you could feel your body sort of say, we're here, and let go.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.